Welcome to Interleaved, where we take a deep dive into topics from the Daf Yomi with modern-day sages of the Torah and the world. I'm Natanael Zelis-Palay. On today's episode, time, Talmud, and technology.
I don't know that it ever hurts to see halacha through the eyes of common sense. And I think that's true both for this and for other areas of halacha. I think it should not be a black box.
The beginning chapters of Masechet Brachot, the first tractate of the Talmud, are rather occupied with the concept of time. The time to recite the Shema, the time to say the daily prayers, even the time King David awoke in the middle of the night. And reading through these chapters, it seems clear that the rabbis of the Talmud thought of and recorded time in quite a different way than we do now. Joining us today to teach us exactly how rabbinic time worked is David Zvi Kalman, who recently completed his doctoral dissertation on the history of Jewish timekeeping. David Zvi is a fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America, co-founder of Jewish Public Media, and owner of Printocraft, an independent publisher of Jewish art books. He received his PhD in 2019 from the University of Pennsylvania with his dissertation entitled Unequal Hours, The Jewish Reception of Timekeeping Technology from the Bible to the 20th Century. David Zvi, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
As you write in the introduction to your dissertation, you chose to examine the intersection of two fields that rarely overlap, the history of technology and Jewish studies. What interests and experiences in your own life brought you to this unusual crossroads, and to the history of Jewish timekeeping in particular?
So I'm sure I'm not the only person who likes both Gemara and science fiction. I think there's actually a growing sub-community of people who have become interested in those two things, but have admitted to being interested in those two things all along. And I think my process towards getting involved in the intersection of technology and Jewish history is really more about coming into something which I realized I always cared about and didn't realize that it was something that was legitimate to study properly. I started out doing a PhD in something that was somewhat different on the intersection of medieval Jewish and Islamic law. And somewhere along the way, as I was pursuing this, I had the realization that questions around technology were just very interesting to me, and they were the things that excited me. And that, combined with some strong suggestion from my wife that, hey, you seem to care about this a lot, maybe you should pursue it more seriously, led me to change course in my studies away from Islam and towards technology, which I'm really glad I did, because it turns out that a lot of people care about technology. I'm one of those people. It's been a lot of fun.
All right, so let's dive into this dissertation, shall we? Learners of the Daf Yomi may recall a discussion on 3b to 4a about Moses' warning to Pharaoh about the timing of the plague of the firstborn, in which the Gemara asks why Moses says kachatzot halayla, or around midnight. One answer given is that Moses was concerned about Pharaoh's astrologers, who are assumed to have been able to calculate the exact time of midnight. Moses feared they would err in their calculations and call him a liar. I found this assumption fascinating. Given your discussion of ancient Egyptian timekeeping in the first chapter, which specialized in the nighttime hours, do you think the Egyptians really believed their timekeeping was that precise, particularly at midnight? Or is the Talmud just making a polemical point about the arrogance of the Egyptians?
So I want to take a step back and address the question of what does it mean to talk about chatzot, and with reference to midnight or midday. One of the things that I attempt to explain in the dissertation is that this is a term which has undergone a significant evolution from its appearance in the Torah to its appearance in Amoraic literature. So in the Torah, when it talks about chatzot halayla, it's not actually talking about a specific point in time. Its uses, it's pretty vague. In general, the Torah's notion of time is not well structured. It does not have strong systems for keeping track of time beyond things like, you know, the first watch, the second watch, and the night, things like that. The Torah doesn't even use the word hour until Sefer Daniel, and then only in the Aramaic portions of Sefer Daniel. So when the Torah talks about kechatzot halayla, chatzot halayla, whatever version it is, we can just assume that this is not intended in any kind of precise way. A shift happens when we enter the Tanaitic period, basically because the Romans do use those terms in precise ways. Midnight for the Romans is the beginning of the civil day, and it's set actually because it's a time when people are asleep, and so it's convenient to kind of start the day when people are asleep, people don't usually stay up until midnight or anywhere near midnight. And midday is also important in that system. So in the Tanaitic period, you start having the term chatzot, both for midnight and for midday, being used in a more precise sense. But there's a further shift that happens when we move from Tanaitic literature to Amoraic literature, which is that the term chatzot stops being simply precise and starts being so precise that a human being could not actually define what it is. And there's actually a shift where there are some Tanaitic sources which are rephrased in Amoraic literature, where if it is a human who is responsible for knowing when chatzot is, the term chatzot is replaced with sheshaot, 6 hours, because that is a phrase, that is a time that human beings could be expected to reckon on their own, but it's also a less precise determination than chatzot itself. So there is this slow shift. The circumstance that you're describing is really something that only comes about because of that end stage where chatzot has become so precise that human beings can no longer determine it at all. And so you can then read that back into the biblical text and say, well, what is going on is that Moshe is kind of telling the Egyptians, God can figure this out, you can't. And so the phrasing is there to kind of provide an out for the Egyptians so that they don't say that God made a mistake. The last thing I would say is, in terms of the Egyptians themselves, one thing that we know about Egyptian timekeeping is that even though it's the Egyptians who seem to have originated the 12-hour night, which then gets extended until the 12-hour day, which is where the divisions into 12 come from originally, we don't actually know that the Egyptians had 12 equal parts of the night. We know that they had 12 parts, but those parts might have been of different lengths. We don't actually know how precise they intended those divisions to be.
Right. And that's exactly the point about the distinction between divine and human timekeeping. That's exactly where I wanted to go with the next question. One of my favorite sections of your dissertation is the one where you discuss the contrast between divine and human time, which comes up also a few pages later in the Daf in the discussion of God's daily split-second moment of wrath. So thinking a little more philosophically now, what does that distinction between divine and human time mean to you today in our world of atomic clocks and maizmanim.com, where we can calculate the zman, the time for reciting Shema or to pray the Shacharit prayer to the exact second?
So the first thing I would say, that notion that God is very good at keeping track of time is something which I've written about, but it's something that Lynn Kay has written about much more extensively in her dissertation, which is now a book, Time in the Babylonian Talmud, where she makes the argument that God is frequently described as being able to keep track of time to a much higher degree than human beings are capable of. One useful example of that is the notion that God can say two things at once, and that idea that you can kind of coordinate speech in that way is another expression of God's great timekeeping ability. But in terms of the question of kind of maizmanim.com and atomic clocks, the rabbinic notion of what it means to keep track of time is, I guess, we would call classical, in the sense that the rabbis imagine that there is a kind of perfect way of tracking time. And what humans can do is attempt to achieve some fraction of that perfect ability, but they can never achieve that perfect ability. I don't know if we have that mindset anymore. One of the milestones in the history of timekeeping that comes about in the beginning of the 20th century is human beings create clocks that are so good that they realize that the Earth's rotation, which has been the foundation of that's the thing that they've been attempting to measure this whole time, is actually not itself perfect, and that there are slight variations in the rotation of the Earth. So one of the shifts that happens as human gets better at keeping track of time is that they realize that the thing that they were trying to keep track of was not actually as stable as they imagined it to be. So I don't know how that fits into the Maizmanim model, which I think imagines that there is a kind of perfect time that one could possibly keep. I think there's a kind of divergence between that notion and the way that we imagine metrics keeping with regards to time outside of a halachic system.
Interesting. Maizmanim.com, I think, even is somewhat cognizant of the impossibility of humans determining the exact time. There's a disclaimer that says, do not rely on these times to the last moment. I don't know if it's just kind of absolve themselves of halachic responsibility, everyone praying or davening past the zman, the time, or it's a more philosophical point, but that was always interesting to me.
Maybe the point is that once you're at the point where you can determine the time to the exact second, you actually can't, maybe you can coordinate the time, but you can't actually coordinate the people, meaning people can't regulate their own behavior to that level.
True. Okay, so now that we're on the topic of zmanim or halachic times, we should talk about time-related sections of the first chapter of Brachot, which appropriately begins with the words from when, Me'imatai. I want to focus on the first Mishnah, which sets the time for the evening recital of the Shema as beginning from when the Kohanim, the priests, enter to eat their truma, their tithes. One of the themes from your dissertation is the disparity between the rabbis' timekeeping capabilities and their expectations of lay people's capabilities to keep time. You write that this could explain the Talmud's preference for relative activity-bound time markers over absolute ones. Given that gap, what do you make of this esoteric time marker of the Kohanim entering the temple to eat their tithe and its presence in the very first Mishnah of the Talmud?
So the short answer is, I don't know. I think the answer lies not with timekeeping, but with the way that the rabbis are thinking about or nostalgic for the temple service itself. I don't know that it's connected to, I don't know there's an answer that lies within the realm of timekeeping specifically. What I would say though, is that in the Tanaitic period, there is a kind of slippage between thinking about time in terms of this newly imposed Roman timekeeping system where there are 12 hours in a given day and the kind of more natural cycles, which are around the rhythms of the day, basically involving when do you get up, when do you go to sleep, when do you rest, and when do you eat. And those things, as they do today, sometimes overlap, but do not always. A good example of this is thinking about what does the word lunchtime mean, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so lunchtime, you would say, is probably sometime around the middle of the day and is around the time that people eat meals. So lunchtime probably isn't, you know, 9 o'clock at night, but which is primary, meaning is it the number attached to lunchtime or is it the fact that you're eating lunch is a little bit ambiguous in that term. I think this is something that the rabbis are struggling with a lot, is thinking about to what degree are we hooking ritual practice to the position of the sun in the sky, which is a kind of abstract notion that people can reckon if they want to, or do they relate it to the rhythms of the day? And I think that that first reference to the way that the Kohanim eat truma at night is kind of playing with that.
So how would a common person, perhaps living far in time and space from the temple, know when that time is? Or is the point that they're not supposed to know? And if so, what does that say about the original audience of rabbinic texts?
I mean, I guess part of what you're asking is, for a person who's not exposed to the temple service directly, are they supposed to have some intuitive knowledge about when the Kohanim would eat their truma? My suspicion is it actually doesn't matter very much. People have a sense of when the evening starts. The rabbis might want to connect that beginning of the evening to this historic act for some reason. But I don't know that anybody is very anxious about it until the Gemara, that is.
Now, on the second side of that first page, the Gemara proceeds to list no fewer than 6 different opinions as to when the time for the evening Shema begins. Do you think it's possible that there was such local or regional variation in the definition of nightfall? Or is this a more technical dispute about the meaning of uvishochbecha, when you lie down?
I don't know that there are technical variations, but I would say that it is easier to come up with terms to describe the different parts of nightfall and the different parts of the beginning of the day than it is for other portions of the day or night, because right, the changing character of the sky or the shifting behavior of animals or the ability to see certain things happens on a rapid enough level that you can kind of create distinction and create terminology. And this is something actually the Romans do just as much as the Jews do. There's the same kind of set of terms to describe different parts of those sequences in ways that there aren't such great divisions after the sun is up. But beyond that, I think it's probably just a technical dispute.
Okay. Things get even more interesting later in the chapter when the Mishnah talks about the earliest time to recite the morning Shema. All 4 opinions give relative physical measures that are wholly dependent on the eyesight of the individual, such as discerning between a dog and a wolf, discerning between blue wool and white wool. In particular, I find it interesting because this time marker made it pretty far into the modern era without being associated with an absolute time, such as 52 minutes before sunrise. It was only in the past couple of centuries that rabbinic authorities, especially in Israel, did so, to associate the earliest time for putting on the tallit and tefillin as 52 minutes before sunrise, when beforehand they would just use the relative measure of mishiakir, when you discern between different colors, when you can recognize your friend. And yet those rabbinic authorities did not necessarily have a sound technological reason for doing so, which brought to mind the question for me, are there some other factors at play in the modernization of Zmanim besides technological advances?
No, I don't think there are. I think it's all technology in some form or another. Mm-hmm. Beginning in the late 14th century, with the introduction of the mechanical clock across Europe, you start beginning to see rabbis, especially in Austria and Germany, and then a little bit afterwards in Poland, become interested in the notion of equinoctial hours, that is, hours which do not change in duration over the course of the year as a result of the passage of the seasons. That's really where you first start seeing rabbis confront the notion of what does it mean to talk about hours in these different senses. And from there, as those clocks become more prominent, where there's a growing expectation that everybody will have access to this time signals provided by these very public clocks, you start having this interest in greater quantification of timekeeping. And then as those timekeeping devices become more accurate, and this happens especially in the 17th century when there's a few technological breakthroughs that make it possible to have both more accurate public clocks and then also make smaller clocks both cheaper and more accurate. Once you start having that happen, this process kind of speeds up. The other element, which also is technological in nature, is the development of newspapers and other ways of distributing information about when Zmanim start, when Shabbat starts, things along those lines that allow these to become more than just locally reckoned changes, but something which you can quantify in advance. One way or the other, it's all.
So time also came up in a different context in the Daf Yomi recently, with the Talmud's assertion that women are exempt from time-bound mitzvot, such as Kriyat Shema, Tefillin, and, according to some opinions, thrice daily prayer. The common explanation for this exemption is that in the times of the Talmud, women were the primary child rearers and homemakers, and with such major responsibilities, could not be expected to fulfill these mitzvot in the limited free time they had. Do you think there's an alternative timekeeping-related explanation, perhaps pertaining to women's access to methods and understanding of timekeeping?
So I don't think so, because I don't know that it's gendered at this point, meaning I think that most women and most men are equally oblivious to exactly what hour it is for most hours of the day. Where there starts to be interesting gendered questions around timekeeping is... you know, what I can think of is there's some research done by a scholar named Alexis McCrossan, who's worked on looking at how clocks show up in kitchens and other domestic settings, other settings that would be populated by women. And she traces how this goes along with changing notions, not just about what women's work is, but a kind of culture of efficiency that was developing around women after the Industrial Revolution, and this notion that women's work should be done as expeditiously as men's work. So that's the only connection that I can think of, but I think it's far away from the question.
In your synopsis asking. Article, you wrote, why Maimonides would later declare that rabbinic hours were always seasonal hours, sha'ot zmaniyot, that is, hours which are always 1/12 of the length of a given day or night. There is in fact no evidence that the rabbis understood the concept of the seasonal hour, nor is there evidence that they understood its alternative, the equinoctial hour, which is always 1/24 of a day-night cycle. Instead, I argue that the rabbinic understanding of the hour was essentially naive. They assumed that hours always remained the same length, but also assumed that there were always 12 hours in a day or night. Can you talk about the process which led you to this conclusion?
The beginning of the process is just to note that the phrase sha'ot zmaniyot does not show up until the Islamic period. Now, Maimonides makes the claim in the beginning of his commentary to the Mishnah that we should not worry about this because we should assume that whenever the rabbis, at least in the Mishnah, use the term sha'ot, they're talking about sha'ot zmaniyot, that is to say seasonal hours, that is to say hours of which there are always 12 in a given day and 12 in a given night, and so their length varies over the course of the year. In examining the corpus of rabbinic literature, which uses sha'ot, which uses that term, it seems that this is a little bit more complicated. There are many instances where the term sha'ot seems to be used in the sense of seasonal hours, and there are many other instances in which the term sha'ot seems to be used in the sense of equinoctial hours. That is, sometimes sha'ot or sha'ah is used to describe a certain point in the day. Sometimes it's used to describe a duration. And it seems like in the former, it's using the seasonal hour terminology. In the second, it's using the equinoctial hour valence. The problem is that in neither of the situations has actually used the term. So it's still just us assuming what is the case. What becomes more problematic is that there are a few instances in which the use of the term is just does not make sense using either definition. So for example, when the Gemara talks about the length that one can walk in a given day, and it says that you can walk 5 mil from dawn to sunrise, and then another 15 from sunrise to midday, another 15 from midday to sunset, and another 5 from sunset to nightfall, those distances should vary based on the length of the actual day, and yet they don't. So the question is, what is going on in instances like that? And the answer that I argue for is that the rabbis either do not know that there is a difference between seasonal and equinoctial hours, or they don't care that there is a difference. And so what happens is that the hour that is used in the Gemara has two mutually exclusive elements. It's both understood to have the same length over the course of the year, and it is understood that there are always 12 in a given day and 12 in a given night. So those two things both can't be true, yet the rabbis seem to think both are true anyways. And my way of understanding how this can be is basically chalking it up to a couple of factors. One is that the rabbis are not using the system so extensively in the first place. So yes, the rabbis do understand that there is a 12-hour day and a 12-hour night. This is their adoption of the Hellenistic system, but they don't make use of it so extensively. So, you know, an hour here, an hour there, who really cares? The other part of it is that late antique rabbinic culture is developed mostly in relatively moderate latitudes. I think the most northerly latitude at which rabbis are writing is, I think, the 34th parallel north, which is still pretty far south. I think that's like the southern United States, the equivalent of that. So at those latitudes, the difference between the longest day and the shortest day is actually not that great. So you can actually kind of get away with not caring about this without too many problems. And I should say, this is not just a problem that's specific to Jews. Islamic culture is also developed at similar latitudes and also comes up with problems once they start needing to think about, you know, what does it mean to have 5 prayers in a day when you're living in Norway or some other northerly place? We already have travelogues from the Middle Ages that suggest that Muslims living at those latitudes are chafing at the requirements of Islamic law because Islamic law is not really developed for those latitudes, just like Jewish law was not developed for those latitudes. So you have the problem because of that. The concept of the seasonal hour comes to Jews through Muslims. The Greeks had it, the Romans had it, but it seems like the Jews didn't acknowledge that. They weren't aware of that. But with the rise of Islam and with Jewish exposure to Islamic science, Jews adopted that notion as well. And so Sha'ot Zmaniyot first shows up in Judeo-Arabic sources and then is translated into Hebrew when texts like Maimonides' commentary to the Mishnah are translated into Hebrew. So really, the time when it becomes popularized in Jewish texts is, it's not even with Maimonides, it's with the translation of Maimonides, and specifically the translation of Maimonides' commentary to the Mishnah in the late 15th century. And we can really pinpoint it very specifically to the printing of a specific edition of his work, where after the printing of that edition, this phrase Sha'ot Zmaniyot starts to show up first in Poland and then elsewhere as a result of the promulgation of that information, which connecting with the availability of pretty precise timekeeping devices at that point starts becoming relevant.
Do you think this ought to have ramifications in current understandings of halakha or other areas?
I don't know that it ever hurts to see halakha through the eyes of common sense. And I think that's true both for this and for other areas of halakha. I think it should not be a black box.
Right.
And this is an area where it's relatively easy to break open that black box and see what's going on.
Your dissertation covers until the beginning of the 20th century, but you write in a recent synopsis article that you hope to cover the rest of that century in a future book. What time-related halacha controversy are you most looking forward to studying? The Tzeit HaKochavim debate, the debate about the exact time when three stars come out, or perhaps the international dateline controversy, which is a fun one, or some other controversy?
So I would say that I don't see the 20th or the 21st century as marking any kind of important qualitative shift in the way that Jews keep track of time. I think it's just this increasing quantification and precision making. So, you know, I would love to know when Jews, for example, first start using seconds when they mark down zmanim, things like that. Mm-hmm. The thing that's I'm most interested in, which I started writing about in the dissertation already, is this weird artifact of Ottoman timekeeping, which has basically been preserved only in the Haredi communities in Israel. The Ottomans, when they adopted European clocks, adopted the physical clocks, but used them in a way that was different from the way the Europeans used them. So the Europeans used them with a few different conventions. The ones that's most familiar to us is where you set noon as being 12, and you let the clock run for 12 hours, and then midnight is 12 again. And that's, you know, that's what we're familiar with today. The Ottomans did something different. What the Ottomans did is they set 12 as being sunset. The clock run for 12 hours and then another 12 hours. And then when sunset came again, they would make a small adjustment to the clock such that 12 is always sunset. Wow. At that point, and this is something which developed over the course of hundreds of years, it didn't really matter that a few minutes might be lost or gained over a course of a specific day. It was close enough. It was accurate enough. And I should say Europeans used a similar method. The Italians used a similar method for a long time. The Ottomans kept up this version of timekeeping until the beginning of the 20th century. Over time, they used it concurrently with the European system because they needed to keep track of both simultaneously. But this is kind of like, this is the official way that the Ottomans kept track of time. It was used in Israel. When the Ottomans set up clock towers in Israel, they were set to this time. When the British took over, there was obviously a shift towards just exclusively the European timekeeping system. And then the Ottomans themselves, or the Turks, abandoned it themselves shortly thereafter. The kind of funny thing is that even though the Ottomans abandoned the system, some Haredi communities, I think, my hypothesis is, as a kind of resistance to state control, kept using the system and continue to use the system today. And you can see some evidence of this in some places in Israel. For example, there is a shul in Yerushalayim called Zohar Chama, which has two clocks, or used to have two functioning clocks on its front face. And one of the clocks kept European time. One of the clocks kept Ottoman time, originally called the Sha'on Aravi. And now it's called Sha'on Eretz Yisrael. So it was kind of like adopted as being this native Israelite thing, even though it has nothing to do with Israel or Judaism whatsoever. Today, it's still used. If you go into Mea Shearim and you look at the Pashkevilim there, you'll see it used on a few of them. The last time I went last summer, I noticed that it was on a Pashkevil from the Neturei Karta. Now, it's not like they actually keep the time. It's not like anybody actually sets their watches that way, but it's a kind of symbolic resistance to the state. And so what you'll see is you'll see that version of time. And then in brackets, it'll have, you know, the actual time, because people do need to know when the event actually is, and no one's keeping track of Ottoman timekeeping anymore. So things like that are very interesting to me. I feel like I don't have the full story there, but I would love to learn more about that.
Oh, that's really fascinating. So we've been looking towards the past in terms of development technology, but to look towards the future, the year is 3000 and there are human colonies on Mars, Jews included. What do you think halachic time will look like then?
So I'd say with my historian hat on, I have no idea. But taking that hat off, wait till my novel comes out.
David Zvi, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Between episodes, you can keep up with Interleaved on Facebook and Twitter. Special thanks to Avigail Halpern for her contributions to this episode, and to our executive producer, Adina Karp.